This recording was made at a public hearing held by the Federal Election Commission on Wednesday, January 25th. Should you have questions after listening to this recording, please call the FEC at 800-424-9530 or email us at info@fec.gov.
Good afternoon. The special session of the Federal Election Commission will please come to order. Welcome back. We have a third panel of witnesses this afternoon to discuss coordinated communications. Just a few words on procedural matters for the benefit of some of our witnesses who were not here with us this morning. This afternoon's panel will last for 1.5 hours, and each witness will have 5 minutes to make an opening statement. The green light at the witness table will start to flash when the person speaking has 1 minute left. The yellow light will go on when the speaker has 30 seconds left. And the red light means that it's time to wrap up your remarks. We will have at least one round of questions from commissioners, the general counsel, and our acting staff director. This morning we were able to have 2 rounds for each panel, and we hope to be able to have 2 rounds of questions for this afternoon's panel as well. Our panel this afternoon consists of Steve Hursting on behalf of the Center for Competitive Politics, and Tom Josefiak on behalf of the Republican National Committee, and Joe Sandler on behalf of the Democratic National Committee. So if our panelists are ready, we will plan to proceed in alphabetical fashion in terms of opening statements, as is our norm. And doing that, Mr. Hursting will go first, and then Mr. Josefiak second, and then Mr. Sandler third. So, Mr. Hursting, the floor is yours when you are ready to proceed.
Thanks, Chairman. Commissioners, Mr. General Counsel, Staff Director, good to see you all again. I'd like to take my 5 minutes, if I could, and address some items I saw in the reformers' comments, if I could. And in order to get it all done in 5 minutes, I'm going to have to do some reading, so I hope you don't mind. And if I could, while I begin, if I could direct your attention to page 28 of the reformers' testimony, that'd be fine. Thank you. In the Christian Coalition case, Judge Green believed that any communication coordinated with a candidate met the definition of expenditure and becomes a contribution to that candidate through coordination. If any of you are reading Judge Green's opinion as sort of a Cliff's Notes on content standards, I want to point up that Judge Green made one error by not addressing Section 431.8b6, which says that before corporate activity can be a contribution under 441b, it must first be an expenditure. And at the time of that decision, the Supreme Court's MCFL opinion couldn't have been clearer that corporate communications are not expenditures unless they contain express advocacy. So when the reform lobby wrote BCRA, they considered amending 441AA7BI to say that expenditures, whether or not they contain express advocacy, made in concert with a candidate are contributions to that candidate. They didn't go that way. They decided instead to add electioneering communications to 441A7. And the first prong of 441A7 remained unchanged. So the term expenditure does have some limiting construction, and the reformers have now offered content standards for the commission to consider, which I think is admirable. The standards they offer, however, are beyond the bounds of law, and I'd just like to list 3 of them quickly. If you'll note content standard 4 on page 28, this standard contains in its definition the very statutory term it's attempting to define. Notice the clause, quote, an expenditure, close quote, that appears twice in the definition. Now, this is not a typo. The reformers know they need this language in the definition to short-circuit whole areas of prior interpretation. The definition presumes that communications by political committees are expenditures. That is, they are for the purpose of influencing federal elections. This is based on a misapplication of the major purpose test by the reformers and by noting that political committees already have to report their expenditures, so what's the big deal? But this is not completely true. Political committees report receipts and disbursements, which demonstrates their spending encompasses more than expenditures. And as the McConnell Court did say, and the McConnell Court did not say that all national party committee spending, for example, is for the purpose of influencing federal elections. National party committees still engage in issue advocacy, party building, and assisting non-federal candidates, even if they have to do it with hard money post-BCRA. There's no reason, for example, that the DNC could not run a hard dollar ad advocating the election of a gubernatorial candidate and still consult with a senator up for re-election in that state on how best to run that ad. But the example I just gave you would be illegal under the reformers' test, even if the ad were objectively designed to advocate the election of a non-federal candidate and couldn't be for the purpose of influencing a federal election. In Standard 5, I would say quickly that if the Commission may not presume political committee spending is in every case for the purpose of influencing federal elections, it may not do so with regard to non-political committees. And my last example, Standard 6 on page 29, following page, is perhaps the most alarming and most telling of the difficulty the Commission would face were it to presume, as the reformers ask it to, that any communication close enough to an election is suspect, rather than stating in clear terms, which the Commission should do, what an election-influencing communication would actually look like. Standard 6, Roman 1, on page 29, applies to communications paid by any entity directed to voters in the district or state of that candidate, for senators that is, whether or not the communication mentions a candidate or a party committee. The Commission would then investigate whether the ads were coordinated with the candidate. But if we were just a little bit later in this year, the even year 06, wouldn't this standard cover the ad war surrounding the Alito confirmation hearings? I count 5 members of the Senate Judiciary Committee who are up this cycle, and the primary season is almost upon us. I believe that Standard 6, by its terms, would require the Commission to entertain a complaint that sought to investigate Senator Kennedy or his staff, Senators Hatch, Feinstein, Kyle, or DeWine, to ask them about ads running in their home states paid for by, say, Progress for America or People for the American Way, to determine whether those groups coordinated their communications with those senators. This is the result of Standard 6. First Amendment activity gets lost in attempts to presume the purpose of a communication largely by the nature of the entity that runs it, or to presume that any communication that reaches voters close to an election deserves an investigation. I'm glad the reformers are proposing content standards, but they need to be better defined. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I look forward to your questions.
Thank you, Mr. Hursting. Mr. Trusefiak.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the Commission. Thank you for this opportunity to be before you again today with a new group of people. So I'm looking forward to a rather articulate and lengthy debate on this issue. Cutting to the chase, to be honest with you, the concern before the Commission today and the issue before the Commission today is really a group of office holders and or candidates sitting down with groups and discussing whatever they're going to discuss. And the issue that we have before us under the old regulations that are currently under debate is within 120 days of an election, everything is suspect. And what does that mean for the Commission? Obviously, the Court of Appeals in the Shays decision did not say the Commission was wrong. What the Court of Appeals said is the Commission needs to justify why 120 days means something. Well, with due respect to the Commission, if you can figure that out, I'm all for it. The bottom line, however, is it's pretty hard to justify something based on a 120-day provision in a statute that specifically was addressing voter registration that has a direct link to elections. What we're talking about here is activity, public communications, and other activity that may or may not, as Steve says, have a direct link to elections. And I think that's the concern I have. If the Commission were looking for a quick way to solve this problem, in my opinion, it would be to take what the legislators had said in the legislative history, what's before the Supreme Court in the court record, and say a 30-60-day window seems to be more justified under the record, by the record, than a 120-day rule. Having said that, the lawyers in this room, and I'm sure the lawyers this morning, all love bright lines. We've argued that for years. And so that whether you're in Washington, D.C., or whether you're sitting in some state and you're not an expert in election law, when a regulation says you can do X, Y, and Z within a certain period of time, that's pretty clear. It's a safe harbor. We all like safe harbors. But again, referring to what Steve was talking about earlier and thinking about this, if the Alito or the Roberts controversy was in October of 06, even though the legitimate questions were legislative questions, where would we be today? It's almost what the Supreme Court was saying in remanding the case in Wisconsin back. You know, here you had Senator Feingold, who was the target of an ad campaign that wasn't talking about his election, but was talking about being against the filibuster. It was a legislative process, not an election process. And quite frankly, the challenge for the commission is going to be, how do you dissect that legislative process from the election process? Just like Joe and I have to dissect, how do you dissect a member of Congress when they're doing their job for their constituency in legislation versus re-election? And that's a tough nut to crack. But that's why in my comments to you, I suggested something that the commission has already been familiar with, and that's the PASO standard. And I don't know, quite frankly, what promote or oppose or attack or support means, but it's something I think the commission needs to consider and come up with some objective standards to give somebody that wants to go beyond the safe harbor, that legitimately have an impact on a legislative process, to be able to do so. And so I think you've got to look at that. And quite frankly, the real frustration for me, and I can tell you a personal experience in dealing with this, was in the endorsement area. As the general counsel to the Bush campaign in 2004, and having dealt with a Kerr AO, and having dealt with a congressional special election within 120 days of a presidential primary, which frankly didn't mean anything, that what happened before 120 days and what happened after 120 days with the same language meant something was sort of ridiculous to me. And it was frustrating to know that you had a whole series of advisory opinions dealing with endorsements. As long as you didn't talk about your own election, it was okay. But in this case, it wasn't okay because you wouldn't have, even as a lawyer, the ability to look at disclaimers without causing a problem. So I just want to raise that to the commission's attention. And as a party person, I have to also say that when McConnell in the Supreme Court decision, based on the commission's own argument, said planning something doesn't mean coordination that's prohibited, I think you have to look at the party committees in a different light than other organizations. And one last note. If the reports are correct and the commission is actively pursuing 527s for 04 activity, I would respectfully submit that instead of worrying about 04, my concern would be 06, because there are a lot of people out there, even individuals, who are reluctant to get involved in legitimate campaign activity because they don't know what the rules are. And I commend the commission for taking this opportunity to try to get some clarity to what individuals, what organizations can and cannot do when it comes to candidates and office holders with regard to coordination. So I'm looking forward to this debate this afternoon. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Yosefiak. Mr. Sandler.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and members of the Commission, and thank you for the opportunity to present the views of the DNC on this important issue. Our focus actually is not on the regulation that the Commission is being required to reconsider as a result of the Shays litigation, which is the rule addressing coordination between outside groups, unions, corporations, nonprofit organizations on the one hand, and candidates and party committees on the other, but rather the regulation, the separate regulation, that defines when a party's payment for a communication is deemed coordinated with its own federal candidate such that the payment counts against the dollar limits on what parties can spend on behalf of their own candidates, the 441 AD party coordinated expenditure limits. That regulation, that separate regulation, which is section 109.37, worked well in 2004. We all understood how it worked, that, you know, if you did something that referenced a candidate within 120 days of an election or the convention where that candidate was up, and if you coordinated with that candidate, it counted against the coordinated expenditure dollar limit. If you didn't, it didn't count. That rule was not challenged in the Shays litigation, but the rule on which it was based, of course, is the one that was challenged. We want to urge the Commission not to automatically conform this party-coordinated communication regulation to whatever new rule is adopted for coordination between the outside groups and candidates, but to carefully consider the situation, the particular situation of party committees themselves. As our comments spell out in detail, there's been a lot of confusion and uncertainty over the years about what the content standard is for party-coordinated communications, but the one thing that's clear is that there has to be one. Some of the reform groups suggested in their proposal that if you're a political committee and you coordinate with a candidate, there doesn't need to be a content standard. It's automatically a coordinated communication. That's clearly never been the rule. Before 1996, before Colorado won, when all party communications were automatically deemed to be coordinated with their candidates, right? There were no such thing as party independent expenditures. The commission still had a content standard. It was the electioneering standard, which they argued for, which your office argued for, and the Solicitor General, Mr. Norton, in the Supreme Court in Colorado won. And, of course, they never reached that issue because they held that parties could make independent expenditures. The electioneering standard was ultimately abandoned by the commission. It was never really replaced. And in Colorado, too, while upholding the limits on party-coordinated expenditures, the Supreme Court essentially invited as-applied challenges if the content standard was gotten wrong. The last thing on that is that in enacting BCRA, without getting into all the gory details of the legislative history, when Congressman Meehan and Congressman Shays came up with their revised proposal after the Senate bill was passed, the way the coordination standard was written, among other things, would have made generic communications, not mentioning, a federal candidate by a party, count against the 441AD limits if they were coordinated. I personally spoke with Congressman Meehan about this, and it was taken out of the bill. So the legislative history is clear that there needs to be a content standard. The reformer's suggestion that it's an automatic coordinated communication is simply wrong. So what should the content standard be for party-coordinated communications? We would suggest, if it's not broke, don't fix it. The court did not require this one to be redone. 120 days is a reasonable standard, we believe, that distinguishes communications that are sufficiently close to an election in a cycle to present the greatest danger of circumvention of the candidate limits by donors, which is the interest recognized in Colorado, too, is justifying limits on party expenditures in the first place. And it's the one benchmark in BCRA itself, in the voter registration definition, that actually applies to party committees. In that regard, I want to make clear that the 2004 cycle, the DNC did not run any public communications outside of that 120-day limit that referenced the federal candidate and, that would have counted against 441AD were coordinated but for the 120-day standard. And the examples in the reformers' appendices are all wrong. They have ad after ad after ad that's run in June and July, which is within the 120 days under the current rule, within it because it's within 120 days of the convention. That's true of most of the party ads that they point to in 2000, not to mention primaries all over the place. They have some in June and April. So that was true of virtually all of their examples from 2000 and virtually all of their examples from 2004. And the final point I just want to make is that, and I think a number of other commenters made that, we would ask that fundraising solicitations that are signed by or reference the federal candidate, the cost of those not count as a coordinated party communication, at least in the areas of mail and telemarketing, not asking for some kind of loophole here for broadcast advertising and the like, because it's just not the situation, again, I think, that's contemplated under Colorado 2, that's really a expenditure that so directly benefits the candidate. Rather, when those letters are signed, it's clearly for the benefit of the party itself, fundraising for the party itself. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Sandler. And beginning our questioning today will be Commissioner Mason.
Thank you. Let me start off by apologizing for the 40-cur AO. I think I voted for it, and I never liked it. So, but let me make one point for the benefit of the party committee councils in particular about the coordination question there, because it was sort of presented to us as, we attorneys just want to check for legal compliance. And at least from my take, when you put a candidate in the ad, a federal candidate in the ad endorsing somebody else, implicit in that is their agreement to the message. And while I suppose we could try to sort of carve out and say, if it's just a review for legal reasons, none of us believe that that is what actually goes on or that it's limited to that. And so there was a presumption there, even though some representations were made about we need to look at it for legal reasons, that, you know, candidates in the real world aren't just going to go out there, show up at the studio, and read the script that they're put in front of them, as somebody this morning put it, for taste reasons, if nothing else. And so, you know, that at least for me, was a sort of on the conduct standard. When you have a federal candidate sitting there reading the text or appearing on screen, that sort of per se meets the conduct standard, you know, for me. Now, I am very much amenable to try to work out a way that we can do endorsements, you know, and allow you to do them, but I don't think claiming that the candidate appearing there doesn't constitute conduct that would otherwise be coordination sort of meets where I want to go. Tom, I wanted to ask you, and forgive me for not being formal, former Chairman Joe Sefiak. you talked about the PASO standard and how you would like that, but of course you and I think the others want something that's a bright line. So what is it that PASO buys you? What are you going to do with that that you're not doing now?
Well, it's a standard that the Commission, and the reason I even raise it, the Commission's already been talking about PASO in other contexts, but it seemed to me that whether it's a 120-day window or a 60-day window, whatever the Commission feels is the appropriate window, that there's more to it than that. And going back to what Joe said, and I want to refute what I believe the legislators submitted to you with regard to, you know, the assumption that every disbursement by a political entity, including party committees, is an expenditure under the definition is outright wrong. I mean, you have to look at what it's not necessarily every expenditure is to influence the federal election. One of the things that I know that the RNC does, and I'm sure the DNC does on the other side, is that once you have a philosophy and you have a president with an agenda and you have members of Congress that either agree or disagree with that agenda, a lot of it's going into the legislative process. I'm talking about.
Yeah, I think the reformers conceded this morning that, for instance, to my example, that coordinating a generic party message that didn't mention any candidates but went to the issue of, gee, should we say vote Democratic to clean up Washington, or should we say vote Republican to keep America safe, or something else? In other words, what the generic party message was going to be, that sort of coordination of that sort of message was okay. And even though their proposal suggests otherwise, I think under questioning they sort of conceded that yes, there were some things like that. So I don't want to get so what does PASO get you? You're the counsel, you know. If we say clearly identified candidate and a time frame, you know the answer. If we add in PASO, what happens?
All right, you pass it. You're within the 120 day. Let's just assume that it's still
whatever
120
time
days. You're within the 120 day window, and you're in dealing with the Supreme Court nominees, and you have a group of individual office holders that feel very strongly one way or another, and you sit down with the party organization and you decide that, you know, you need to make it clear what the position is on one of the nominees, and you're urging your fellow members to support that nomination and not filibuster or whatever it is. Under the old regime, with the 120-day window, you mention a federal candidate, and if you're coordinating and you're going back to that either district or state to urge that candidate to do something, that's going to be a problem. And what I'm saying is that, you know, that's fine when it gets you a safe harbor, but you should have the ability, if you're willing to go and run the gamut, that you're not going to be chilled in your right to make that kind of a statement without causing some angst.
But what likely scenario would you need or want to be coordinating with the candidate you mentioned? In other words, if your Republican members come in and say, we got to drum up support for Alito, the presumption is they're in favor of Alito. And so I'm trying to understand why it would be necessary or even likely that you would be coordinating with the candidates you mentioned. In other words, you're in that scenario, most likely you would be naming Democratic candidates.
Maybe. You never know. Yeah. And
if the answer is, well, then you shouldn't coordinate that ad with the opponent of that Democratic candidate, it seems to me the limitation, the effective limitation, is small.
Well, I don't know. But it seems to me that one just, when you come up with a hard and fast rule, it becomes very difficult to counter that rule.
You think we ought to allow as-applied challenges?
Well, I don't think you have a choice at this point. It's coming your way.
We want to note that we're for as-applied challenges here where appropriate. Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I apologize to the panel. You're getting here in the afternoon, and I sort of discharged a lot of my energy in the morning. So this may not be as spirited as this morning's debate was. Mr. Josefiak, you seem to be partial to the PASO standard. Now, would that just be for party committees or for everybody? Or do you care about anybody else?
No, I think it's in respect. Obviously, I'm a party person, and I would like to see that at least for the parties. But I think, you know, as the court in Colorado said when it came to independent expenditures, and you know, again, this was a counter to my position about some of the legislators who thought there should be a different standard. The standard's the same. I mean, if you're going to be able to, you know, you're going to have to at some point, whether the commission does it in a balancing act or, in my opinion, the court's going to do it in a balancing act, there's going to be an ability for some fundamental First Amendment right to redress your legislators on various issues. And whether you're going to be referring to someone who happens to be a candidate at the same time, I think, is the challenge you have. In my world right now, the president's no longer a candidate, so it makes it a heck of a lot easier. But if you took some of the same issues that we're dealing with right now and you took it back a year ago, it would be problematic. And I don't think when you and I don't know what the answer is, and I know you've got a challenge, but there is a fundamental balancing act that the commission should be at least attempting to say it's all or nothing at all is wrong. But there's got to be some balancing between your fundamental right be able to redress your government and talk about these issues when you're talking about someone who's up for election at the same time of protecting, so you don't have the other extreme where they're using the so-called issue ad to have that influence. And that's where we started with this. If you remember why we ended up with BCRA in the first place, it wasn't against the coordination issue. It was against the use of soft money to pay for it. And all of a sudden, this got snowballed to the point where you can't talk to anybody. And quite frankly, from Joe and our standpoint, we're using 100% hard money. So we're even more baffled of the fact that we can't even talk to the people who are supposed to be representing us to talk about an issue that may be appropriate in that particular state if we refer to a federal candidate, either the opponent or the person who supports that position.
Well, that's the trick, isn't it? It's figuring out the way to distinguish between the real issue ads and the sham issue ads. And that's, you know, what all of this is all about. I regret very much that
all I'm saying
you're not giving
is
me
I
an
think
answer
you should
to that
give it
question.
A college try.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, but you're not giving me a lot to work with there. Mr. Sandler, you seem pretty comfortable with the 120-day limit. And I appreciate the sort of I obviously was not responsible for the 120-day limit. I can't take credit for it, can't take the blame for it. But I appreciate the sort of intuitive feel that, you know, oh, it sounds like about the right amount of time. But the court basically told us that, you know, we need to have some evidence for that. That and particularly said that the argument that, hey, it's double the 30-60 days, the 60 days of in the electioneering communication, the court said, well, why is that relevant? And so I guess my question to you is, if you want us to keep the 120 days, do you have anything that we could provide to the court as empirical data or empirical evidence that would back it up?
Well, first of all, I think that the data that's in the notice of proposed rulemaking itself about when these ads, the periods of time when these ads tend to be run, is certainly compelling. And then in addition to that, I think the fact that the reformers' own example show that all the ads that they cite were in fact within the 120-day window is also good evidence that if they believe that this is the kind of, you know, these are ads that influence an election, well, guess what? They're within 120 days, not without it, at least insofar as the ads they cite that are, some of them they cite are run by the candidates themselves, which are mm-hmm. completely irrelevant. But the ones that are run by the party committees, an issue of concern to us, were within the existing window.
And I think we all appreciate your pointing that out. That's a very helpful. I'm sorry that there isn't anybody from the reform side on this panel that could be sitting here and respond to that, because it seems to me to be pretty good.
We ran out of reformers.
We ran out of reformers.
We'll
pair
them up.
We can ask Larry tomorrow. We've got one more coming.
Great.
It's hard to imagine we ran out of reformers. And I guess the flip side of that question for you, Mr. Josefiak, is since the court explicitly said, you know, why is the 60-day window relevant that you would double it and get to 120 days, what possible justification do we have for cutting back to the 60-day window, which the court didn't seem to like very much?
Well, I think it's the legislative history, to be blunt about it. The people who supported the legislation and the data that, and the studies they presented, quite frankly, said that, from their experience and the studies, that that's the two months before the election is when most of these ads ran. And they were, again, looking back at the issue ad controversy and how they were using issue ads, from their perspective at least, to influence elections without the buzzwords.
Right, but we tried that argument. We lost. So so how do we get there?
Well, but I think, in my humble opinion, the reason you lost is you had a 120-day window without any explanation, and instead of being able to argue the 60, I mean, that was sort of, in my mind, a second-tier argument, because you already had on your face a regulation that said 120 days without an explanation as to why. And my theory is that it's, you know, if you're going to use 120 days and you're looking for analogies in legislation, there is one. The problem with the analogy in the legislation is it dealt with an issue that was directly related to election activity. Voter registration is directly tied to an election. You can't vote unless you're registered to vote in most places. And so there was that direct correlation. And so in coming up with the 120-day rule, the legislative history was such they thought that period for direct election-related activity was there, and it would have to be 100% federal election activity after the 120 days. Before that, you could use, in fact, soft money to pay for a portion of it. That's, I think, the difference that we're dealing with here in the kinds of conduct we're dealing with. One is party activity in the voter registration area, and one is a communication, where, again, their focus was public communications that didn't have the magic buzzwords of elect or defeat or oppose, but had the image of a candidate, and they were talking about things that were pretty close to the line. And I think that's where you've got to look at this and why they did what they did. And so I think there is a very legitimate distinction between the 120 days and for election activity versus 60 days for this general public communication.
Time's up. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Commissioner Weintraub. Commissioner Von Spakovsky.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Hershey, I'd like to start with you a question, since you were commenting on the proposal that the reformers put in on what the rule should be. My question to you is, one of the points we made this morning, myself and Commissioner Weintraub, was that the rule they were putting forward seemed so complex that it would be extremely difficult for people to understand. In fact, someone reminded me during lunch that that rule might make a good chapter in Charles Dickens' Bleak House, where the court case took an entire lifetime because the rules of the Chancery Court in London were so complex no one could understand them. I wonder whether you would agree with that. And the second part of the question is, the rules, frankly, seems geared towards, unintentionally or intentionally, to hurt challengers the most and to benefit incumbents. And I wonder whether you would agree with that.
For the latter half of the question, you're talking about the reformers' proposal?
Yes.
Certainly a virtue, Commissioner, of the content standard is that it provides a bright line. It's cliche at this point. The virtue is, though, is you start to narrow the activity in which people know they will be investigated. 3 or 4 years ago, it was sort of cool to want to ban landmines. And I think the reason that sort of resonated with people is they realized that if you're just walking around, that's probably not enough notice, that you probably need to set up another standard. Similarly, simply speaking is not enough of a defined line in terms to when you will be investigated. So the virtue of the content standard is, particularly when it's clear and well-defined, is that anybody can follow it, whether or not they can afford good counsel. And would I say that the reformers' proposal in terms of rules benefit incumbents? Yes, I would, because what the effect of those rules is to presume a lot of activity is for the purpose of influencing an election and therefore regulable. All things being equal, incumbents need to spend fewer campaign dollars than do challengers. So if the question is how do you spend campaign dollars legally, and the harder that becomes, the more it will benefit incumbents. That's certainly right.
So you wouldn't have a problem with us, instead of constantly referring to the reformers, to maybe changing that to the IPL, the Incumbency Protection League?
I would have no problem with it. We're working on it. I'm a one-man band right now, but we'll get there. About
now, I have a question for the whole panel, and it's this. Another issue that keeps being raised with us is the IPL is very worried about ads occurring outside the time limit, whether it's 120 days or whether we shorten it to 60-30 rule. What I wonder about this is all the data I've seen, including polling data, indicates that the average citizen doesn't pay attention to political races and elections until shortly before the election. And that even if a rule like this were to push some of these ads outside of this time period, it really wouldn't matter because, frankly, while the TV stations that get the ads might be happy for the money, it's just going to be wasted money for the campaigns because people that far out from the election aren't really paying attention to it. And I wonder whether you agree with that assessment.
I certainly do. I've not read all the studies, and I know there are several out there, but yeah, I think that's very likely that people just simply don't focus until about Labor Day.
Commissioner, I'm assuming that the content of your ad is such that it wouldn't really be clear to folks that it was indicating to a potential voter to vote for somebody. I'm assuming that under your scenario it would be,
yes,
what would be, for lack of a better word, an issue ad in the sense of the word. And the question is somebody going to look at that as opposing or supporting without the magic words, is what I think you're talking about.
That's
a whole other ball game if it's clear on its face of what the message is and who's giving it. But I tend to agree with that, and I can't speak for Joe, but I think that in the era of trying to keep as much money as you can for when you need it, those kinds of wasteful expenditures are sort of not a good use of the resources that people have donated for the purpose of electing or defeating somebody, and you're going to use that much more wisely than just deciding to do an ad for the sake of doing an ad, 6 months out from an election, unless it is, in my mind, a real legislative ad. Why else would you be doing it unless there was a reason that you want to do that? In the sense of a legislative proposal or an agenda proposal or a philosophical view of a party rather than a position of a candidate that's going to affect the election or re-election that early on.
Okay. No more questions.
Thank you, Commissioner Von Spakovsky. If I can manage this high-tech equipment, which is always a challenge for me. A couple things. I've appreciated the discussion today about the Forgy Kerr AO, which I realize is not really anyone's favorite advisory opinion. And I think the general sense, as much as I think we've all tried to forget entirely that proceeding and how we came out on it, was that the result was in large measure dictated by the current regulations, and that the regulations were not perfect. We thought there were some virtues to them when they were passed in 2002, but that the Kerr AO was difficult because as we looked at the law as it existed then, we just didn't see a way to get out of that result. And in that regard, I'm pleased that we're putting on the table now in a rulemaking setting whether we ought to make some allowances in the rules to have a different result. And I guess my question for all the panelists is, would you be comfortable if we had an exemption for endorsements, provided that the advertisement did not contain express advocacy for the candidate who's doing the endorsing? Is that something that, in general terms, you think would be appropriate for the agency to fashion? Mr. Sandler?
Yes. We would think that's appropriate. I think it wouldn't have, even if it was a PASO standard rather than express advocacy, it would still work. Endorsement ads are not promoting or supporting by their nature, by any reasonable standard, unless they're twisted to do so, the candidacy of the endorsing federal candidate. And furthermore, again, if you look at the rationale of Colorado II, no one's going to give to the party in a sort of secret earmarking to promote a candidate because they're appearing in an ad that's endorsing, you know, to help a presidential candidate that's appearing in some ad for a congressional candidate in Kentucky. It doesn't make sense. An exemption for endorsements is completely consistent with the underlying rationale for party expenditure limits as articulated by the Supreme Court in Colorado, too.
Mr. Giuseppe, would you be comfortable if we had an endorsement test, again, premised on a lack of express advocacy?
Maybe I should share some of the blame for the confusion that the commission had based on Commissioner Mason's view of what was going on here. I think we laid out a number of potential scenarios, but what was frustrating in my mind was not necessarily the candidate sitting down and taping anything. It was the ability of even taking a picture of the president and putting that on the screen, and the fact that we couldn't even make sure that the disclaimers were right without jeopardizing that, or the right the picture was being used. I mean, there are pictures and there are pictures, and there are some pictures that, quite frankly, would be not the right picture to be using of the president of the United States. And so even if we weren't saying anything, or even if the president wasn't even aware of the fact that he was going to be used as an image, the fact that no one associated with the campaign could even review it without putting that 120-day window into jeopardy was what was really frustrating for us. And you know, trying to get some feedback from the commission as to how what you could do. Maybe you couldn't do that. Maybe the president couldn't sit down and say, hello, I'm George W. Bush, and I want you to vote on Election Day for so-and-so and put that in the endorsement because, you know, she was such a great candidate. But just the fact of someone getting a picture that was asked for from the campaign to be able to be used and therefore then not being able to check it out to make sure that's the picture they were using was where we found the frustration.
Mr. Hursing, if I could follow up, if we were to do an endorsement exemption and we had two options, one would be to condition it on the absence of express advocacy, and the other would be to condition it on the absence of PASO for the endorsing candidate. Would you have a preference between those two options?
Absence of express advocacy or the absence of PASO?
Yes. Is there one that's preferable in your mind to the other?
Yeah, I would say absence of express advocacy.
And why would that be?
Because we're talking about 441AA7, which is expenditures, and PASO and expenditures have tended not to meld in BCRA. PASO is black letter law, so is expenditure. They're not easily melded. That's the reason for my preference.
Mr. Stanley, you indicated this, and Commissioner Weintraub is absolutely right. We had a spirited discussion this morning on the reformers' proposal, maybe the last proposal of that detail that they submit to us, but we had a spirited discussion. But Mr. Stanley, you indicated that as you understood the reformers' proposal, that with respect to political committees, that essentially there was no content standard at all. I think their view would be, yes, there is a content standard. It would turn on whether or not the communication is for the purpose of influencing a federal election. In your view, would this agency lawfully be able to adopt such a standard?
No. Clearly, that's not consistent with the legislation. Again, under that standard, generic party communications, and Mr. Hurston gave an example, which amounts to the same thing of endorsing a governor, but if you just say, you know, vote Democrat because of this, and this issue, and it's coordinated with candidates, that's never been considered a coordinated expenditure, and it wasn't under the commission's electioneering standard going back to the mid-80s. The standard that this commission advocated for in the U.S. Supreme Court in Colorado won. So I don't think you lawfully could do that. I think
is that because it's impermissibly vague? That there wouldn't be sufficient contours for people to be able to comply with the standard?
I think that it would be impermissible because, I mean, again, using the Supreme Court's view from Colorado, too, it's too much of the party's own speech and not implicating enough of the concern that justifies limiting party coordinated communications to begin with. Say, for example, not even mentioning the candidate that you're coordinating with.
My time has expired, and Vice Chairman Lenhart is next up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One of the difficulties that we confront in this process is that we are engaged in writing this rule again because the Court of Appeals found that our earlier rule wasn't a satisfactory explanation under the APA. And they have asked us to build a factual record. that would support whatever rule we do adopt. As difficult as it may be, among the three specific questions that the Court of Appeals asked us, and one which they identified in their opinion as the most important, was the extent to which election-related advocacy that now occurs within the 120-day period would move into whatever unregulated time period we had, and the degree to which this would foster circumvention of the Act. Largest sort of concrete factual record we've received is from some groups that are advocating that we adopt a very broad standard. And principally this, consists of a collection of articles from the National Journal Data Bank about ads that did run outside of the 120-day time period. Most of these ads are candidate ads. There are a small number of ads that were funded by groups that are not candidates or candidate committees, but the ads are to the point that there is, in fact, money spent for advertising outside of the 120-day period that is for the purpose of influencing an election because the candidates themselves are doing this sort of spending. I take Mr. Sandler's point that, in fact, if we were to go back and look through these, we would find that, in fact, some of these ads do fall within the 120-day time period, and they simply didn't calculate or calibrate all of the different triggering events for those windows, and we will do that and try and discern what. But this morning we're citing about 200 ads. What I wanted to get a sense from any of the witnesses, really, who are comfortable talking about it, is what record is there? What can we look to that would point to the adequacy of either the current 120-day time period or a different one that would reflect that, in fact, the kinds of spending on ads that are for the purpose of influencing an election were occurring within the time period that we would select? So anybody who has thoughts on that, I would be interested in hearing those.
I would say, Commissioner, I would say, Mr. Vice Chairman, I would say that the buying time studies are certainly relevant. Those are what Congress looked at when they passed the electioneering communication provisions.
Those were raised earlier in the day, and if I can interrupt just for a moment, my sense was, or at least one of the contentions raised this morning, and I'm not sure whether it's true or not, was that those studies were built around studying whether the statutory period was appropriate or not. It didn't cover the breadth of time that we were dealing with under this provision of law. Is that your recollection?
It's not my recollection. The studies speak about activity in June and July. So that's 100. They talk a lot about activity 129 days out. So that's certainly not within 60 or 30. The other thing I would recommend that the Commission look at is independent expenditures by national party committees. And the reason for that is that when the national party committees went to completely federal dollars, any dollar was just as good as any other. So that means any dollar could be used for unvarnished advocacy or defeat of an opponent. So if you look at when the national party committees were willing to spend their IE money, I think that'll be illuminating to the Commission. I also think what you should not include are expenditures by authorized committees. And the reason I think that is because in the 441AA7 context, we're really talking about other organizations who coordinate with an authorized committee and try to pay expenses on his or her behalf. And therefore, the amount of funds that authorized committees spend themselves in order to build name ID for 2 years really shouldn't be particularly relevant to the Commission. And if I could say one more thing about it, with regard to AO 2004-1, I think there's a dovetail here. They talk about Blair Hall's activity in Illinois. Well, he's an authorized committee. I don't think it's relevant. And dovetailing to 0401, there's no history of corruption between authorized committees, federal candidates. There just isn't. If you look at prior commission regulations, they've never said payments by one federal campaign committee to another federal campaign committee create a coordination problem. There's nothing in that, in the rationale of Buckley about corruption, nothing in anti-circumvention rationales of Colorado Republican or of McConnell. So officeholder to officeholder contact, particularly federal authorized committees, is not a problem that has ever been recognized by courts or Congress. So for that reason, I think authorized committee spending can be put to one side in terms of building a record.
Mr. Chairman, I know my time has expired. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chairman. Mr. General Counsel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good afternoon. I guess my first question is for Mr. Sandler and Mr. Josefiak, and I want to return to the question of an exception for endorsements. The chairman has suggested an exception for endorsements other than ads that contain express advocacy, and I guess I have two questions. One is, in light of the court's decision in McConnell, where the court said the presence or absence of magic words cannot meaningfully distinguish electioneering speech from a true issue ad, and famously referred to express advocacy as functionally meaningless, is it appropriate for the commission to import that concept into new areas of the law? And second, I guess this is more directed to you, Mr. Josefiak, would you have an objection to the commission creating an exception for endorsements but not ads that promote, support, attack, or oppose the candidate doing the endorsing?
How do you want it? You want the first of all, I don't think that McConnell sort of focused on the endorsement issue in the sense that it was somehow looking at the issue ad in the same way as an endorsement ad, because the very nature of an issue ad that was the genesis of all this was referring to a specific candidate and urging that candidate to do X, Y, or Z with regard to something that was coming down, or, you know, we think he's a great guy and continue supporting him and that sort of thing. So there was a built-in under what you're saying, attack, promote, support, there was a built-in recognition that somehow you could read that into it. I think that the fact that you have a candidate that does not make any reference, and this goes back to the old advisory opinions the commission issued, made no reference to whether or not that candidate was up for election, him or herself. And granted, when you're at the presidential level, people are going to know that by its very nature. But in a lot of places, if you're dealing with a senator endorsing a congressman or a congressman endorsing somebody else, they're not even going to pay much attention to what other issue may be lurking out there other than the immediate election that they're asked to endorse. And I think that, you know, that's sort of the genesis of all of this. What do we know about the person that's on the screen? What role is he playing? Almost a two-hat theory that we use in other contexts, that I'm a member of Congress, and I am the leader of the party, and I'm out there asking people to support somebody at the lower level to be able to be part of the team that's going to get a legislative agenda approved. As long as I don't refer to my election or somehow be viewed as, or there is no glowing statement made by the person who's being endorsed that I'm doing this because I want to see that the president not only gets reelected but his agenda gets passed, that raises it to another level. But if you get somebody out there that has no reference back to themselves but is only talking about, you know, somebody else, I think there's a legitimate place for that. And I think you can use – I don't think that the McConnell decision precludes the commission from taking that position, the bottom line.
If we would be comfortable, I think, with the promote, attack, support, oppose standard. And it would – to a certain extent, it would limit – what can be said in an endorsement advertisement. But if you look, for example, at the Weinzapfel advisory opinion, you know, and assume that that was one federal candidate endorsing another, I think you would conclude that the endorsing candidate, in that case it was a Senator Bayh, was not being promoted or supported, nor was his opponent being attacked. So,
Mr. Hursting, the circuit court in Shays, and sort of wrapping up its coordination analysis, said, the record before us, however, provides no assurance that the FEC standard does not permit substantial coordinated expenditures. You point out on page 7 of your comments that, according to the Buying Time study, a 60-day period would capture over 80% of what the Buying Time study considered coordinated electioneering ads. My question to you is, would the commission's use of a 60-day standard assure the court that the regulation was not permitting substantial coordinated expenditures?
That's an excellent
question. Is 20% of uncovered ads too much?
I'm not sure what will persuade the court. That's a great question. If I were the court, I'd be persuaded, I think is the best way I can answer that question in fairness. But if you look
at... We nominate you for the federal bench?
At least. Do you know somebody who could do that? But within 120 days, roughly 95% of electioneering ads are covered. But I would like to believe that let me start over. The court has sent the commission back on a fact-finding mission. The commission needs to go back and look at the buying time studies. It needs to look at IEs by national party committees. When it does that, it will find that the record supports a 60-day standard. Public
communications. Let me just follow up for a second. I know you wanted to talk, Mr. Josefiak, but my question is really for you, so you'll have a chance.
Thanks.
you're suggesting that we ought to really equate what went into the electioneering communication rule in fashioning a coordination regulation. But it seems to me there are some meaningful differences, that the electioneering communication rule was a rule generally applying to outside parties that says that without further evidence, we can look for certain attributes in an ad, and we're going to conclude that it was for the purpose of influencing an election. In this context, we have more in front of us. I mean, you've talked about the content standard as creating a suspect class of communications, but it was really intended as a filter. And the focus really has to be on, was there a request for that ad? Was there material discussion about the ad? And don't those kinds of things provide separate indicators for the commission to look at in determining whether a communication was for the purpose of influencing an election? And therefore, to say, well, we ought to equate the analysis here with the support for the electioneering communication rule really ignores that in this context we have a lot of conduct to look at that might help indicate to us that we've got a communication that's for the purpose of influencing an election.
Sure, but I think you're going to look at the request for the ad is not going to come from the endorser. If that's the request from the ad is going to come from the person who wants the endorsement.
I'm sorry, I was trying to step away from the endorsement context and speak more generally about the 60-day standard that you're advocating.
Okay. But in that regard, in looking at the studies, and going back to the issue is, that's why I had a sidebar with Joe, is to my understanding, we were very... not only do you have to look at when ads ran, but I think for the purposes of this regulation, and whether it's 60 days or 120 days, was there coordination? And we were taking, and I think Joe was too, when it came to these kinds of public communications, we weren't letting anybody coordinate with anybody on these things. It was just the concept of, so it's not just when ads ran. It's whether or not they would have triggered something and whether that they were really independent from any sort of coordination issue. And I think that's more relevant here. And not necessarily looking at when ads ran, but I just think that certainly it's a filter. But the question is, is that the end game? And my point is, I don't think it can be an end game. It's certainly a safe harbor, but I don't think it can be the end game.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Norton. Mr. Costa.
Mr. Chairman, my questions have been answered by the panel. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Costa. Well, then we can begin a second round of questioning, and we can begin with Commissioner Mason.
Okay. Gentlemen, help me out. The criticism about 120-day or 60-day was in part related to the test that we then used, and in essence was pointed at the express advocacy test. And Steve has pointed out the problem that I fully recognize of it's sort of a chicken and egg question about whether you have an expenditure first and then that has to be coordinated, or does the conduct of coordinating turn something that otherwise wouldn't have been an expenditure into an expenditure. It is, by the way, I acknowledge, very hard to read the statute that way, because the statute 441AA7B starts with expenditure.
All right.
And then it says if an expenditure is coordinated, it's contribution. And so it's very hard to jump to the end of that discussion and say, oh, well, if something's coordinated, it's an expenditure, because that precisely begs the question to be answered. But I think the vulnerability is lies in part in the McConnell decision, and that is, how do we answer the question or the charge that McConnell, though it claimed otherwise, in fact overturned Buckley, because they swept away the express advocacy decision as constitutionally required. And of course, it's sitting there in the statute and definition of independent expenditures, and maybe in another place or two. But they seem to say, well, this is now only an exercise of statutory construction, So we could say, well, yes, it applies to everything except BCRA, everything that BCRA didn't change as a statutory matter, but then they told us it was functionally meaningless. And some discussions about constitutional standards have gone back to what if there were a constitutional standard, for instance, dealing with ghosts.
Right.
Because in 1789 everybody believed in ghosts, and you know today we don't. And so, how do we deal? How do we enforce a standard that the court has essentially declared to be a ghost?
I think there are a couple things here. As you know, 441A7, particularly Roman 1, is a core FICA provision. And the Supreme Court in McConnell said that the Buckley gloss remains on FICA provisions.
But then they said, but it doesn't mean anything.
They said it's functionally meaningless. And then they also said, and I'm paraphrasing, we invite Congress to do more, because when they do, we'll be ready for it. That's the point. You have to look at what Congress has done thus far and what was the gloss placed on that. In fairness, the McConnell Court, under jurisprudence, can only address those things that are amended by Congress. It can't put new spin on old statutes. That would be inappropriate jurisprudentially. So 441A7BI is an old standard. It contains Buckley's gloss, theoretically. The McConnell thing about functionally meaningless says, Congress, we have no problem with electioneering communications, and when you want to send us more, please do. Now, the problem you have, in my opinion, I'll speak very bluntly here, is you have a district judge who doesn't really get the nuance of those arguments, and you have an appellate court that didn't focus on them. Let's put it that way. So now you're sent back to a factual inquiry to build a record for the content standards you have already promulgated. And I wish you well in that. But if you and I were discussing the whole FICA, Buckley, BCRA, McConnell regime and what that timeline looks like, then that would be my answer.
Well, I'm not sure what your answer
what
is.
You do,
because
what
the question
you do
is whether it's 60 days or 120 days, we're still vulnerable to a charge that outside that time period we're allowing explicitly election-related ads to be coordinated under the guise of a functionally meaningless standard.
Right. Well, two things. I'm sorry to Tom and Joe. Just the last thing I'll say about this is that oh boy, there it goes.
Let your colleagues help you.
No. Yeah, please go ahead.
But remember that the Congress could not agree on what the rule should be for coordination, and consequently left it to the commission to come up with it. And the only direction was that it wouldn't, with respect to the conduct standard, could not require agreement. You know, they're trying to overturn the Christian Coalition case with respect to the conduct standard. Again, in terms of the party coordinated communications, there was a conduct standard in place, you know, well before BCRA. Congress did nothing to address it or change it. I think the commission has a good deal of leeway in determining what the appropriate conduct standard is for the, you know, in coordination, and is not limited to every kind of everything that falls under the, you know, under the definition of expenditure.
Mr. Chairman, I apologize. May I,
Mr. Thurston?
What I wanted to say. Thank you. Sorry about that. I just wanted to say that the record also supports the notion in the buying time studies that lobbying ads run at all times during the year. So if the commission says, yes, we have it down to 95%, or yes, we have it down to 80%, we think that's enough, because the same studies we're looking at to figure out where the 80% and the 95% outliers are, those same studies tell us that issue advocacy, genuine issue advocacy, happens 365 days a year. So in terms of that balance, the commission's going to be happy at, I would say, 80%, or happy at, say, 95%. But the idea that you could now and forever stop every possible ad that someone would think is electioneering, I think it's beyond the commission's capacity, and I don't think a court would hold you to that standard in the future. I really don't believe they would.
Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As you know, I wasn't here for the first go round, so I don't know whether I would have voted for the original set of coordination rules or whether that's the all-time perfect set of coordination rules. But if I'm hearing you correctly, and I'm directing this more at Joe and Tom, you would say that you've been living with this stuff for a cycle, you understand it, your client understands it, and it's working to the, you know, as far as it goes, and you'd rather that we make fewer changes rather than more changes rather than, you know, start off on a search for the all-time perfect standard. We're better off sticking closer to what we've already got.
Well, let me address specifically the context of the National Party committees and their expenditures, the question of when their expenditures are coordinated with their presidential nominees, because my colleagues who represent the Congressional and Senate committees have submitted their own comments and own views. So let me limit myself to that context. Just as a factual matter, the 120-day standard knocks out essentially the entire presidential election year, except for certain narrow windows in certain states. So the early states, let's just forget Iowa, New Hampshire, and let's talk about like the opening of the window. And I'm not sure exactly it's going to be in a way, but say more or less.
It's different from both, but it's going to be close.
Right. The beginning of March, there's a period of days, you know, assuming that. To say it's 2008 with the party out of power, convention's going to be in mid-July. There's a period of days in that series of five or six states when if the party wanted to, they could coordinate with a presumptive nominee if there is one, and there often isn't one after the first round, without having it, you know, without having it count against 441 AD by virtue of the 120-day standard. Let's look factually. Did that happen in 2004? I can state unequivocally for the DNC, it did not. You will not find in these 200 ads that these reformers have had any example of that. That's outside 120 days, and it's not an, you know, independent. We didn't run any independent expenditures that early anyway. But an ad that but for the 120-day standard would have had to count against 441 AD, and we didn't count it.
And just
didn't happen.
It worked out, and Joe is right. From our side, because of how late the convention was, that we may have a early, you know, we started almost the same time in January. January was really, I can't remember exactly what the date was, but it was sometime in January of 06 where the 120 days kicked in, and then it ran all the way through for us because we, you know, we were. By the time we got there, and I think on Joe's side, there may have been a two-week window or something between the convention and the when the 120 days would actually kick in for the general. But it was very small. I mean, and nothing happened. I mean, for all practical purpose in the presidential cycle, once you hit the election year, it was just you're within 120 days of something or other all the way through.
Right.
Would you see any reason for having a different standard for congressional, Senate, presidential races? That's one of the questions the court wanted us to explore. So,
no, I mean, I don't think.
I don't think so because when you're dealing with the presidential, you're dealing with a nationwide campaign and one message. When you're dealing with the congressional, you're going to have You know, you get some primaries that are as late as September, some early primaries, and you just, I mean, and you're talking about a specific candidate for a specific election. You know, Senator Reid talking to Senator Reid about some race in another state isn't going to impact on Senator Reid's election in the state of Nevada and vice versa. I mean, it's different running a national campaign versus running a statewide campaign, and I don't think the rules should be any different.
Now, one of the hypotheticals that was discussed this morning was this notion that outside of the 120-day window, there's sort of a free-for-all because express advocacy is functionally meaningless. And, you know, this is what the reformers' concern, that you get outside that 120-day window and then a candidate or a party committee or whoever could go to an outside party and essentially say, here is the ad that I would like to have run. I don't have the money for it. Please run it for me. Are you aware of any instances of anything like that happening? Ever?
No, I'm not aware of it. Again, this, from the standpoint of coordination between parties and candidates on the one hand and outs, you know, outside organizations on the other. But again, I want to focus my remarks on coordination between party and their own candidates. And again, the record will show that did not happen. And I think that the commission could also look at the factual record with respect to the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee. Did they run ads referencing candidates outside the 120-day window that were not independent expenditures, but that they did not report as 441AD by virtue of the 120-day rule for the cycle when it was in effect, 03-04, I think you'll find the answer is no.
And I just want to get it for the transcript.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, I'm not aware of anything like that. If anything, it was, you know, the concern was so great about this issue that you just not, I don't think you're going to find it. I'm not aware of it.
Mr.
Certainly from the party committees.
No.
Okay, thanks. And one more quick question, if I could. I appreciate the record that the chairman is trying to build for an endorsement exception that would have, that would permit endorsements as long as there wasn't an express advocacy component for the endorsing candidate. But following up on the general counsel's question, which was almost exactly the question that I was going to ask, assume that you have a commissioner that, having read McConnell, might feel a little bit squeamish about throwing around that express advocacy phrase too much and might feel more comfortable with the PASO standard. Would that still work for you if you had a an exception that said you can endorse candidates, it's not going to count as coordination as long as it doesn't PASO the endorsing candidate?
And I think our comments actually reflect that. I think it's better than nothing. I mean, personally, I would love to be in the express advocacy world again, but we're not, based on McConnell, and I think that's the best we're going to do. But the challenge is to try to figure out, in looking at the six of you, as to what you're going to view as PASO and what is not. And that's what was the beauty of express advocacy. It was clear. Now we don't have that luxury anymore unless we get some new direction from the court. But until then, I think that's the best we're going to be able to do. At least it gives us some option here.
I appreciate that. Mr. Sandler, would you agree?
I do agree with that. As I say, you could see where the PASO standard could limit the content of an ad. I mean, instead of just showing B-roll of President Bush with the candidate, if they said, you know, if the president was taped saying, well, you know, this candidate Smith will work with me, be a great partner in Washington in the fight against terror, blah, 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 probably would be PASO, and therefore, if you did have such language, it would count as 441AD for the, you know, with the presidential. But I think that's a reasonable place to draw the line. You would have to observe those kind of content restrictions.
You wouldn't have too much trouble drafting the text of the ad that
correct.
You would feel comfortable.
Exactly. And again, you know, steering clear of that. Once you steer clear of the PASO, I think you've also comfortably steered clear of implicating the interest again and identified in Colorado too and limiting a party coordinated expenditures.
At least we know what the limits were and we could adjust accordingly. That's better than nothing.
Thanks.
Sometimes better than nothing is the best we can do, right? Commissioner Von Spakovsky.
I have one question, but the setup to the question is very long, so I'm gonna pretend I'm a U.S. senator and spend almost all my time asking the question.
We can extend your remarks for 20 minutes. If you
I want to go back to the current rule we have, which would seem to obligate us to prosecute endorsements. Because the way I try to look at these regulations and rules, and I'm certainly new at this because I'm new on the commission, is to relate it to election history and how campaigns have been conducted in this country. And, I mean, this rule reminds me of a famous story from Georgia. You know, in 1964, Bo Calloway was elected as the first Republican congressman since Reconstruction. And the way he did that was that he took advantage of an interesting quirk of the politics of the time, which was that although Georgia was solidly Democratic and you had to be a Democrat to get elected to local or state office, Lyndon Johnson was very unpopular. And Bo Calloway used an advertising campaign, and whenever he would get to a fair or anything else where the other candidate was, which was an incumbent Democratic congressman, the first thing he would say when he stood up was, hi, I'm Bo Calloway, I'm running for Congress, and I want you to know that I'm going to be voting for Barry Goldwater for president. And then he would turn to the incumbent congressman and ask him, who are you going to vote for? Now, the incumbent congressman was in a very tough position because if he said that he was going to vote for the Democratic president, he would be in trouble with the audience. If he said he wasn't going to be, he would be in trouble with the Democratic Party. Finally, the very end of the campaign was the first televised debate in the history of the state. The incumbent congressman sent a staffer over to Calloway and said, the only way I'm appearing at this is if you promise at the televised debate you will not ask me how I'm going to vote for president. Bo Calloway agreed to do that. They televised the debate on WSB, which is still a station in Georgia. And the first thing Bo Calloway said when the debate opened was, well, I'm not going to ask my opponent who he's going to vote for president because I promised not to do that, but I want you to know I'm going to vote for Barry Goldwater. Now, the reason I bring this up is that my understanding of our current rules are that if the FICA and BICRA rules had applied then, we would have to prosecute Bo Calloway for doing that kind of an endorsement in his communications and fine him for doing that, even though I see absolutely no corruption in his doing that kind of endorsement, and I don't see the appearance of any corruption. I mean, what corruption is there existent in that kind of a situation that should cause us to regulate it?
Commissioner, if I might, let's go back a little bit in time here. We had 270 days to write, and I say we. I used to work here. I shouldn't say we. The commission had 270 days to write a raft of rulemakings, the original BICRA rulemakings. And take it from me when I tell you what has caused all this AO 2004-1 problem and all this endorsement problem, particularly from federal candidate to federal candidate, is the word that, where it should have been a. If you're really interested in this issue, I commend page 14 of my comments to you, and you'll look at the history of this, and you'll realize that in a flurry of madness, the commission put a payment made by someone other than that candidate. That's actually contrary to a statutory provision in BICRA, section 214C, which says we require the commission to write new regulations for payments by persons other than candidates, authorized committees. So my understanding of the history is it got missed, and the simple word that has created all this turmoil. And I commend to you page 14 of my comments. I would read the next two or three pages, and the way out of this, particularly from federal candidate to federal candidate endorsement, is to put the word A back in where that used to be. You're doing a rulemaking. Now's the time.
The other issue, I think, first of all, what we were talking about in the Curio was a public communication that had all sorts of other implications to it, not somebody getting up on a podium and saying something. Hopefully there's still that First Amendment right to speak as long as it's not costing anything. But beyond that, I think, the Curio was serious because you had to make a decision if you were within the 120 days whether you were going to do it or not, and the decision would have been made not to do it if we're outside the 120, within the 120 days, because that's not a very good way to spend money in a state that's not targeted when you know that you only have certain resources to spend. Having said that, I think more problematic, and quite frankly, speaking for the party, and I have to think in terms of not only does the RNC support federal candidates, but state and local candidates as well, I think this becomes much more problematic for the member of Congress that wants to go and endorse a local candidate. And if you're going to treat that as some sort of allocable expense to that candidate, and how does that impact on the whole soft money issue when you're dealing with a gubernatorial candidate, for example, that's raising non-federal dollars and wants the endorsement of a senator from that state, if the senator isn't going to pay his or her fair share of that cost based on an allocation formula on time and space. So I think you really got to look at this and set sort of, that's why I like the PASO at least. At least you can be able to demonstrate that if a Senator X is out there and endorsing his or her local legislative team that somehow that legislative team will be able to do it as long as there is no opposing or supporting or attacking the federal candidate. There's got to be some recognition of what the role is of a senior member from that state with regard to the other elections that are going on.
Thank you. I guess I'm next up. And Mr. Hursting, I think appreciate your testimony on the that versus A issue. I'm going to take a hard look at your comments in that area. And I also appreciate Commissioner Weintraub's thoughts. If we're going to do these an exemption for endorsements or solicitations, if the choice is between Express Advocacy and PASO, I think it is highly relevant for us to look at how the Express Advocacy test fared in McConnell, and it's got to be part of our decision making. And I appreciate the testimony from the witnesses that they felt like they could work within a PASO framework. I understand, Mr. Hursting, you kind of part company on that issue, but I think Mr. Josefiak, I think I heard you say at one point that another possible relevant factor in the endorsement setting is whether or not the endorsing candidate is identified in his or her capacity as a candidate in the communication. Is that another indicia that we ought to focus on or consider in fashioning, if we were to fashion an endorsement exemption?
Well, it was certainly a focus of the commission in previous AOs, looking at what context that you were being perceived as the senior party leader in the state that was trying to get someone elected, or as opposed to someone that's trying to use that to help you get reelected. I think that was one of the indicia that the commission looked at. So I think it is important. Right now, for example, we don't have the problem on the presidential side because the president isn't a candidate. So if he wants to go out and endorse everybody, that's great. We don't have that problem anymore. But, again, a year ago, it was a problem.
If we looked at an indicia like whether or not a candidate is referenced in his or her status as a candidate, or whether or not there's a reference to voting or the election in the communication, would that be a way for us to get out of the conundrum of having to choose between Express Advocacy and PASO, perhaps, in fashioning an endorsement exemption?
Well, you could, but there's another way you could look at it from Commissioner Weintraub's standpoint. That could be part of the PASO, sort of checklist. How are you going to decide that issue? Well, that's one of the indicia. Is that person recognizing himself or herself as a candidate for election in their own right? And then you can move from there.
Are you inviting us to define PASO?
Well, somewhere along the line, and it may take 25 years, but you're going to get there, just like you did with Express Advocacy over the years versus Express Advocacy, the bright line versus the infamous Firkgash decision, where it wasn't such a bright line. So, one way or another, the court's going to force the commission to get there.
I'm sure we all look forward to that project with great relish. And the other thing I wanted to follow up on was in terms of solicitations. And there were some questions in the earlier panel in terms of a possible exemption for federal candidates and office holders who are soliciting funds for national party committees or other state party committees. And we assume that in doing those types of solicitations, those candidates and their agents are going to be looking at those pieces before they go out, making sure that it makes sense politically what's being said in those pieces. Would you be comfortable if we fashioned an exemption in that area, conditioned on the absence of PASO in terms of the office holder who's signing the piece, Mr. Sandler?
Well,
sort of a parallel issue with the endorsement issue, except it's dealing with fundraising, solicitations for other entities.
The problem is that it gets to be somewhat difficult if in the absence of earmarking, a candidate that signs a fundraising solicitation for a party committee can't refer to their own candidacy as being part of the effort that the party's making to get its candidates elected. I think that we probably would find most practical, a broader exemption, but maybe that's limited in terms of certain types of public communications. For example, I don't think the commission would want to allow broadcast communications to be exempt from 441AD if they just had some fundraising pitch added to it. I think we're talking here about traditional fundraising, direct mail, and
would you be comfortable
with marketing.
Would you be comfortable with an approach that covered media that are not essentially the electionary communications media, are not broadcast television, radio?
That would certainly work.
And combined with that, are you saying essentially that you prefer some sort of the absence of express advocacy as the test there for solicitations, or that you're just not as comfortable with PASO in this environment?
I just don't think that PASO will work in this context, and it should be express advocacy some other.
Mr. Josefiak, your thoughts on that?
Maybe my client should hire Mr. Sandler, because I've been taking a very conservative view of this, and I'm sure my client would love that. But we took the position basically that if you're going to be signing a letter like that, there could be no reference. And so if the commission's going to allow that, I'm all for it, but
no reference, I'm sorry, to
no reference to your own campaign.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And so that, I think that would be a great move. It would certainly solve a lot of problems. But, that kind of clarity, I think, would be needed, because I think there are a number of institutions, not only at the national level, but when you get down the trail to the state and local level, that need to know that. Because right now it seems to be a confusing state of affairs. There is no, in my mind, there is no distinction between a fundraising letter that refers to a campaign versus just a generic letter that goes out to get somebody to vote for somebody, because part of the vote process is also a solicitation process, and it's difficult to exclude them. But I'd certainly be for some sort of an exemption that would allow that, so that we wouldn't get our clients into any sort of hot water with the commission.
Thank you. Mr. Vice Chairman.
Thank you. If I could just go back to some comments by Commissioner Weintraub, I wanted to highlight that the reference to the express advocacy standard as functionally meaningless was also quoted by the Court of Appeals in the Shays decision that has led us all to this room today. And so it is obviously a concern. It may be a bit of an aside, but Mr. Josefiak, you mentioned a couple of times today that the national parties were engaged in lobbying activity as well as efforts to get their candidates elected. And there were some comments, I'm not sure, I think it was this morning, where people were operating under the assumption that national parties did nothing other than get their candidates elected, while it was not only their primary purpose, it was their sole purpose. If you could just detail briefly what, if any, activities the national parties engage in.
Sure. And I wouldn't classify it as lobbying. I classify it as grassroots activity, although under the most recent legislative proposals, grassroots would be lobbying. But I would look at it as the point of going back to the grassroots through the state party and to the county levels, through the email process, getting people engaged to write their congressmen and senators to support the president's position on Social Security and to get their members to vote for that, or welfare reform or tax cuts or the nominations before the Senate on the Supreme Court, and to try to activate the base to get out there and do something to encourage their members from a legislative standpoint. Part of the deal is you win elections, but that's not the end all of a party organization. Once you win elections, you're responsible for governing, and part of that governing is to get what you promised across so that you can get reelected again. But the idea is that you ran on something. It wasn't just because I'm better than Joe or Joe's better than me, that we ran on a platform of trying to do certain things. And once you get in, you want to perform on that. And there is a great deal of effort going into the process to encourage the electorate from the base all the way through, including independents, to go out and support the president and to let the members of Congress know that you support a particular piece of legislation that's pending before the Congress. I think that is a vital part of what we're doing. My chairman likes to say, you know, not only worried about, you know, winning the elections in 06, but getting the president's agenda through. And we've got 3 years to do that. And it's an important part of what the national organization does. And it encourages the states to get involved as well. It is a grassroots effort. So, you know, the idea that everything that we do is to influence an election, I think, is not to understand what a party organization is and what it's supposed to do under our own charter.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, if anyone else had, I'd like to use the balance of my time if any of the other witnesses have anything to add.
Well, there's no question that you can. The DNC runs all kinds of communication, has in recent months and weeks on issues, you know, opposing the agenda of the Bush administration and taking them to task on, you know, national security, wiretapping, opposing the nomination of Judge Alito, and all kinds of things. Not one of which mentioned any active candidate for office. I don't think anyone would suggest that if those kinds of communications are discussed with Senator Reid, the Senate Minority Leader, and it's run in Nevada, that should count as some kind of 441AD expenditure. I mean, that's what we're talking about here.
Thank you.
One of the reformers said that should be regulated this morning.
Mr. Chairman, I have no further questions.
It was implied.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chairman. Mr. Norton.
I have no questions. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, Mr. Costa. Okay, that concludes then our session today. The Commission thanks very much the three panelists being with us this afternoon, and we will be in recess until tomorrow morning when we will resume the coordination communications hearing. Thank you very much.